Hello, and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And I'm really excited to welcome the Bowie band perennial and the complete guitar legend, the one and only Earl Slick, to the podcast. In this episode, Slick and I connect over Zoom to talk about his central role on the 1976 masterpiece Station to Station. Slick, as you probably know, was hired by Bowie at the tail end of the Diamond Dogs tour in 1974, while Bowie was metamorphosing into the young American soul boy, something which slightly baffled the 22-year-old session guitarist, who definitely dwelt in the grittier end of the rock, soul, and R&B spectrum. Nevertheless, Bowie really liked his loose, adaptable style, as did his other guitarist, the bandleader Carlos Alomar. The pair struck up a strong musical bond which laid the groundwork for Station to Station, recorded the following year over a series of long, intense sessions at Cherokee Studios in Los Angeles. As well as Slick and Alomar at the core of the band, we had the ace rhythm section of Dennis Davis and George Murray, and Roy Bittan on keyboards. Bowie and Slick were both firing on all cylinders musically at this point, and in fact, the music was pouring out of Bowie and his band with such intensity, he and Slick were relying heavily on stimulants to stay on top of the flow. As Bowie himself commented some years later on Slick's playing, "I got some quite extraordinary things out of Slick. I think it captured his imagination to make noises on guitar and textures, rather than just playing the right notes." So in this episode, which is the first part of our conversation, we begin at the beginning, back in the 1950s, and things just go on from there. There are lots of insights, diversions, digressions, and revelations, as well as an appearance from Slick's very own Diamond Dog, who you might hear snoozing in the background, the king-size canine Tank. So without further ado, let's get into it, and I hope you enjoy.
I mean, if you look at Elvis, he was a product of the 1950s from the United States of America, which at the time was in an absolute turmoil, not dissimilar to what's happening now. In the 1950s, you know, if you walk down the street in any city in this country and you just looked at who was walking down the street, all the men had the same clothes, the same haircuts. Mm. They all wore fedora hats. All the women had the same haircuts. They wore the same skirts and dresses and makeup.
Yeah.
Then you go to the 1960s and you walk down any street in New York City. Those people are still there, but now you got guys with long hair. Another guy's wearing a tie-dye shirt. Then you get to the 70s, same thing. Then you get to the late 70s, and now you've got the long hair guy still there. The guy in the suit is still there, but then you've got guys with spiky punk haircuts and green hair. That didn't happen in the 50s. I mean, it was it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It did progress as time went on. So Elvis was the product of that time. So as time went on, it got more diluted and actually more integrated. There's no way that you could walk down the street in any major city in the United States in the 1950s and even look a hair different. You were outcast.
So individuality.
Yes.
Individuality. Now, you were a kid when the Beatles played Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
And that was a bit of a light bulb moment. But for you personally, the Beatles opened that door and the Stones were what kept you there. You saw this happening in front of you.
Yeah.
This transition from a very homogenous, conformist society to this culture of individual expression. Yeah, you were there.
Yeah. Well, here's the other side of that coin is that when we saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan's show, they had more of an impact. It wasn't just on the kids. The adults were absolutely appalled.
Yeah.
I mean, revolted, appalled, mad, angry, scared. You could take the most notorious, you know, flesh-eating death metal band right now. It wouldn't shock anybody. Nobody would even pay any mind to it. We've become very desensitized. And with the advent of social media and the internet, we're getting more desensitized by the day. So stuff like that, it just doesn't, anything like that doesn't carry the same weight. Now we can transition into when we made Station to Station. At the time, that was considered like out of the box. That was like progressive. And now when I look back on that, I don't know, it sounds like a really, really creative rock and roll band.
There are so many things about that particular record which were revolutionary. For a start, he was a guy that every record he made changed the game
right.
in some way. But like you say, I mean, I'm not old enough to remember the 70s myself, but I can certainly remember seeing footage from that period. It always blows me away how inventive and daring these records were and how straight everyday society was. That era has gone where an artist like Bowie could just bam, 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 every year change face entirely.
Well, also...
You know, you get what I'm saying.
I totally get it. And part of that is technology, because had we had, in 1975, when we recorded that record, access to the technology, the Pro Tools, and all of that stuff, that record would not have been that record. Not in a million years. It couldn't be that record, because we had a limited, and even then, we recorded that on, it might have been 16 track, maybe, okay, yeah. It might have been 24, but I'm thinking it could have been 16. So you were limited to just how many takes you could do without wearing the tape out, you know, because every time you roll that tape, you start to lose quality, and you can bounce tracks together and make it more than 24, but every time you do that, down goes the quality. We always had in our minds, we have a limited.
There's a limit to what we can do.
Whereas now there's no limit. You could put 10,000 tracks on a song and you could just infinitely just keep putting tracks on.
But as an artist, you have to impose your own limits, don't you? I mean, you're still writing, you're still recording, you're still creating music. How do you get around that? Like in your most recent album, how do you approach that? Do you impose boundaries on yourself?
Yes and no. It's not even thought about, and it's not even discussed amongst the guys, because we all come from that. What's the goal here? The goal is the big picture. Like when the last record I made, the instrumental record, it wasn't actually meant to be, really. I had some tracks in a can, and a friend of mine who wrote some of the tracks with me, he pushed me to do the record. I really didn't want to do the record. And he said, you know, at the time, I was busy doing other things, and I also was thinking a little old school, like, okay, in the old days, I could go get a major record contract. And I've been signed to major labels. I'm going, well, who's going to hear this thing? Why do I want to go out and try to flog this thing, you know, and go through that whole nonsense again? And especially in this day and age where the budget money isn't there that you want from the record companies. And I thought, why bother? But then he said, just do it to do it. And I thought, you know what? That's the best way to do this, to do it to do it. And then we'll see what happens. And it sat there for 6 years before I actually released it. 6 or 7 years.
Really? Yeah. 6 years.
Yeah. That was recorded.
Recording and release.
That was recorded in 2013, maybe, or 14. It sat there. I didn't know what to do with it. I had no idea what
you
to
had
do
Reeves
with it.
You had Reeves on a track or two there, didn't you?
Yeah. Because me and Reeves had, about a year or two before, we went in the same studio, and I just said, hey, let's just book the studio for a week and just record a bunch of stuff. So we... And that stuff's in the cam. We haven't even released that yet. There's a whole other batch with vocals with a singer on that one. And yeah, Reeves did. He was around when I was doing the last record, and he does some really cool texture stuff in there. It was live. I mean, when we cut that record, I remember on one or two of those tracks, in the middle of recording the take, I wanted it to go somewhere else. And I literally just looked at the guys and it went there. That's the
like
magic.
Telepathy.
Exactly. That's the magic of that. I mean, David.
And that can only happen when you work with a certain group of people, right? Like
you
need to be able to lock into people and communicate telepathically with
them. Yeah, you're not going to do that if you got a bunch of session guys reading music. That can't happen.
Yeah.
But if you go with guys that you've connected with and you're all on the same wavelength, it just kind of happens.
Well, hey, is that Tank?
It's the Tank. It is.
That's the Tankster. There he is. Talking about dogs, this is where I want to take you now, because I believe your first engagement with Bowie was Diamond Dogs.
Yeah.
You came in at the end of the Diamond Dogs sessions, right? So just maybe let's pick up there, and if you can just take me back there.
I met David at the end of the sessions. They were mixing the record, actually, when I met him.
And that's, you weren't a big fan, were you? You didn't.
No,
you weren't that familiar with his work.
No, I had one Bowie record. You know. So I didn't really follow him. I bought Aladdin Sane because there was some amazing guitar work by Mick Ronson on that, you know? So that's what prompted me to buy the record. And, you know, some of the songs, like the two songs that I bought the record for was Gene Genie and Panic in Detroit. So it's Bo Diddley and you know, Muddy Waters.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, Gene Genie is Manish Boy.
Okay, I felt Gene Genie was more Bo Diddley.
No, but that's...
No. Panic in Detroit.
That's Bo Diddley.
That's Bo Diddley.
Absolutely. That's Bo Diddley.
That's his American Ziggy album, isn't it? I mean, that album is so dripping in America.
Yes, and you know, and then you add in Mike Garson's insane jazz piano, and it takes that record to a whole level that, I mean... I actually hear, as innovative as Station was, I look at Aladdin Sane more like that because of putting that piano against that rock band was it was a genius mistake. And Mike pulled it off like no other piano player could ever pull that off.
Do you know he recorded that in Trident? And the piano he recorded that on is a fabled piano. I think it was the piano that McCartney did Hey Jude on. And I think Freddie Mercury used that. And Mike was talking about that piano when he came on the podcast. It talked just about that solo. And he was talking about the synergy between him and this piano. And he felt it was almost like the piano was playing him doing that solo.
You know, it's funny that we all have a weird superstition thing like that about that, you know. When you walk into Abbey Road, because I've recorded in there many times, you can feel it in there. And when I had the band with Ian Hunter, the Overnight Angels, we recorded that band in Canada with Roy Thomas Baker. When we went over to do the tour, we started in London, and he wrote a tune called England Rocks. And we recorded it. Oh, was it called Wessex? It was the same studio with the same engineer that did the Sex Pistols. And it has that same urgency and even a lot of that sound, if you listen to it, even though it's a completely different animal. We felt it in there.
People will, you know, go to extraordinary lengths to get that Abbey Road sound, or to get that Olympic sound, or to get that Trident sound. You know, these iconic historic studios have a sound, don't they?
They do.
A timbre.
Yeah.
Yeah, they really do. So when you came in at the end of Diamond Dogs, was that at Tony Visconti's studio? I mean, he had that place. I think it's...
No, it wasn't his studio. It was at RCA Studios where they were mixing it.
Oh, that was RCA, right?
In New York.
What did you record anything for the album?
No, I came in. The audition was a very weird thing. I thought that I would be in a room with a band, and that's how you audition, right? It wasn't. I walked in, and I was led into the main room of the studio. There was an amp in there, and I plugged into the amp, and Tony spoke to me over the intercom and just said, hey, play along with it. He didn't tell me anything about
it. Was?
I know I played along with the title track and maybe Rebel, little bits of them though, not even, I mean? Little bits of stuff. Yeah. I think they just wanted to see what would happen if I came in on the blind, you know? So that's how we did it. And that was the audition. I mean, I think it was, that part of the audition was maybe all of a half hour. That was it, 30 minutes. Wow.
It's a fascinating way to check someone out, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, there you go. Bam.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Throw it back.
Yeah. It takes a lot more than learning a song and playing the notes, you know? I mean, especially because I was being hired to go do the tour. The record was already done, so my first job was going to be the tour. So playing live music, every time I would see a band, they would play the solo exactly from the record. I'd be bored. I had the record. I know what the record does. I wanted something else. And that's what, you know, somebody like Bowie would bring to the table. He didn't want to mimic the records. I mean, if you look at years of videos of the songs that were recorded early days that we were still doing on tour to the end of the day, year by year, some of the arrangements, those songs are almost unrecognizable sometimes.
You played on the 2000 gig, didn't you, the BBC?
Yeah.
There was the first time I heard arrangements that really blew my socks off. The reworking of Let's Dance he did there.
Yeah.
He did Absolute Beginners in a totally different way as well. I mean, that was really, you know, you guys probably did do different versions before, but I remember that gig so clearly because of the way he broke tracks down and put them back together in an amazing way. But yeah.
I mean, that's what makes it work. You know, for certain, not all artists, it doesn't work for all artists, you know, especially when you're getting into the real pop music, it has to be what it is. But, you know, when you're getting into other areas, I mean, look at the Stones. I mean, from tour to tour and clip to clip, you know, sure, there's a couple of signature things that you want to do, but the rest of it should be open for interpretation because that's what inspires you.
They've got to play the cowbell on Honky Tonk Women. They've got to do the same solo on Satisfaction. Well, you know,
yeah.
It's what people come to hear. I get your point. And I think Bowie was definitely one of those artists who likes to keep it fresh. So much so that when you went on this tour, this is crazy, and I still love the story, he changes the tour halfway through.
Yeah.
So you go on the Diamond Dogs tour. Everyone's like, okay, it's Bowie, Halloween Jack, Diamond Dogs. And then this Philly Soul Boy shows up, and you're in the middle of this. How do you deal with that? Like, you've joined this tour, and then the whole thing changes.
I bet. Mike Arsenal, Van Nurl, Slip on guitar. Gregory Gunn-Jones, Doug Roach on bass guitar.
By surprise, at that time, I didn't spend a lot of time with them other than at work, you know. So I went off my own way all the time. But when he started talking about R&B, because we did speak about that even during the Diamond Dogs tour, because I talked him into doing Knock on Wood. That's why that's on that record.
I love that version.
That's my idea. It was my idea to do that. So to me, that was what he was talking about. He called it R&B at the time. That's what I thought. That's Memphis. You know, that's Sam and Dave. It's Eddie Floyd. It's Otis. It's Steve Cropper. It's that thing. But the direction he went in is what took me by surprise, because he went more in the pop direction, like the Philly Soul, which is a completely different animal, as is the Motown. So you had like the Motown, the Philly, and you had the Memphis. The Memphis stuff was a lot more gritty than the other two.
Right.
Much less
the
polished.
So the definition would be the Philly Soul was far more polished, far more produced,
yes,
lush, whereas Memphis Soul was, how would you say, what, more gritty?
It was gritty. And you know, even the, if you listen to like the guitars, like that Alomar did, because Young Americans is really an Alomar record. I mean, I'm there.
And that's very Philly, yeah.
But that's what he did good. And even the chords that he used and the sound that he used was completely different. Because if you want to compare that, and if you talk about Memphis, you're talking about Steve Cropper, that kind of guitar, completely different style, completely different sound, which is what my ears were hearing that. I didn't really hear that other kind of guitar playing because I never listened to it.
But around that time, that was starting to get into the mainstream, wasn't it? So Philly Soul was becoming gradually more top 40 friendly. It was becoming more dominant. And I guess that paved the way for disco, right?
I guess in a way, yeah. And at the time, David wasn't doing it because for commercial value, really. He liked that. He got into it. You know, so he used that as a springboard, what he was listening to make that record. You know, so we did it where they did the records. We went to Sigma Sound where they made all those records.
So you've come off this tour, which has been quite a crazy experience because the tour itself replicated Bowie's change of direction. You know, he abandons he physically abandoned the old set halfway through, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Left that somewhere and then comes on as this sort of soul review.
Yeah.
And so that must have been pretty weird for you then to recalibrate yourself.
Oh, it completely was, because it changed the face of the whole thing. You know, I was coming from a blues, rock and roll, Memphis soul kind of thing before I got with him. So this was foreign territory for me, and I wasn't very comfortable with it. I really wasn't.
I can imagine coming from that background, and now it's like, all right, we've got to play.
It was too clean and polished for my liking at the time, you know. It didn't, you know, in hindsight, if you look back on it, it didn't last that long because it was only in the fall of that year. We abandoned the Diamond Dog set at the end of the summer. By September, we did the last, I think the last Diamond Dogs show that we did was at the Universal Amphitheater in sometime maybe September. And then from September to the end of the year, that was all the Philly Soul ones. It was only 3 months.
But what's it like working with Bowie at that point? What was the atmosphere like in the studio?
Honest answer, it was a fucking nightmare. We were all using a lot of drugs, but, you know, because David had more money than me, he used more drugs than me. It wasn't a good time for him. It really wasn't. How he actually got that record finished and actually made such a good record is just a testament to willpower, I guess. I don't know. But, you know, he kept changing direction, and he wasn't pleasant. It was weird. It really wasn't weird. Yeah. It was weird at all.
A lot of sessions for that, weren't there? I mean, at one point it was going to be the Gouster. They'd come up with a bunch of tracks. Then Tony Visconti gets involved, and then, you know, it changes around again.
Yeah. So
a lot of back and forth and indecision, I imagine.
Yeah, and some of that was recorded, like, in little breaks from the tour where we had, like, 3 or 4 days off, and we'd go to Philly for a few days. That's funny, is that that's a period that my memory is not wonderful about that period. I think maybe because, you know, I didn't feel like I was part of the thing in the first place, so it's a bit fragmented.
But were you present for most of the sessions? Did you play on most of the tracks?
I my guitar's probably on 3/4 of that record, uh-huh. if not more, but to be honest, there was nothing that I did on there that was very memorable to me. Maybe 1 or 2 little bits that I did.
Were you there for the Fame session with Lennon?
Yes. Okay. Yes and no. My body was there. I have very vague memories of those sessions. Mm. And when I met John the first day of recording Double Fantasy, it wasn't until then that I was absolutely sure I was on that session because he told me I was.
So he remembered you from the session.
But I didn't remember him.
Because
now that's out of it.
Walker, hold on. Slick is Sluck. What? Well, it's not me because I ain't playing.
That's Slick, it's you. Oh. Just tune to get the nose off of Yui.
Where's Fred? Give me a fix, Fred. I'll kill you when you get here, you bastard. Give me a black one.
Because you'd worked with Yoko, hadn't you?
The stuff I did with Yoko was post-John's. It was during, the Double Fantasy and Milk and Honey sessions. And then the March of 81, 3 months after the assassination.
Yeah.
Right. We went and did, that was, you know, she got a lot of flack for that from the press. As well, she got flack no matter what she did. But,
right.
You know, media and press being as insensitive as they can be to get a story, they didn't sit back to think that maybe this is a bit of a therapy session for her and the band, because it was the same crew, same studio. Everybody was there except the producer, Jack Douglas, who did Double Fantasy, and I have no idea why he wasn't there to this day. But he was the only one not there. So it gave us a chance to kind of get together after the fact.
Well, I read that they got Spector in.
That was a nightmare.
Yeah.
And I was so looking forward to working with Phil Spector. But even back as far as 1980, he was already crazy.
I mean, he was crazy back to the 60s, this guy. I mean,
yeah, but he was a whole, his crazy had progressed greatly by 1980, because he was walking around studio with one of them Clint Eastwood 44 caliber guns the size of a cannon and a shoulder holster. I mean, you know, considering that John was just shot 3 months earlier.
Yeah.
I was going, what is this guy thinking? And he just was a nightmare.
Then apparently Yoko said to you after a couple of days, he's gone. Don't worry, he's not.
Yeah, what happened was is that we got in the elevator at the same time to go up to the studio. I said, and I didn't even say his name. I said, what time is he getting here today? She goes, he's not coming back. That was the whole conversation. That's all I needed to know. I was fine. Jack Douglas had also worked previously with John. Mm. And I think she was looking at bringing familiar faces in that worked with John. And that's probably why Phil was there.
Right.
But
right.
I don't know how long it lasted. Maybe 2 weeks.
With Phil.
Yeah. I don't think we didn't keep any of it. I don't think we kept one bit of it that we did with him.
That band that you had on Double Fantasy was an amazing band. You had the guys from Cheap Trick. She put out studio versions of tracks some time ago. A couple of years ago, there was like a Double Fantasy stripped version or something. You heard that?
The stripped version. I was there when they were mixing that. And the Double Fantasy and the Milk and Honey record, that's just the band that I was in. It was myself, Tony Levin, Andy Newmark, Huey McCracken on the other guitar. Tony DeVillo was the supervisor. George Small played keyboards, and Arthur Jenkins played percussion.
Yeah.
We were the band in the studio, and then later on, some backing vocals and stuff came in. The Cheap Trick stuff was recorded before that.
Right. They did that great version of I'm Losing You.
Right. And the thing about that was that John loved it, but John, it just sounded too much like Cheap Trick. That was the problem. You can't hide that. Yeah. You know, that's what they do. That's who they are, and they're a great band. One of my favorite bands and really good friends of mine. And that caused me and Rick Nielsen to have a little bit of a press war back way many years ago, which we cleaned that up a long time ago, you know, because I was on the final version and whatever. Yeah. We got silly. Great guitar player, great band. But John wanted, I think he also was looking more of a diverse session band, which wouldn't have been me. Because, you know, Hugh McCracken...
Diverse in what way, though?
Diverse way. Like, Hugh McCracken played on everything from Simon and Garfunkel to every major session that came through New York City. Everything from pop records to you name it. Tony Levin was the new bass guy on the scene. Mm. Andy Newmark had played with everything from Sly to Roxy, you know, all that kind of stuff. So they could do... and read anything, because they were all reading charts. I wasn't reading charts because I couldn't. And I was the element that John wanted to keep the rock and roll street value offset the session thing. Even though the way those guys played that record, it just sounds like a rock band to me, you know, but that's why they're good at what they were doing.
So John remembered you. You didn't necessarily remember being at that session itself, but you were on that Young American session. How do we get from Young Americans to station? So just maybe talk me through that a little bit. What happened next?
So we started recording Young Americans at the same time we were doing the Philly Soul Tour.
Right.
And it finished recording it, might have been very early 75 or maybe late 74. And I was in Los Angeles getting ready to do a solo record with my band. And I hadn't heard from David, so I was getting ready to go in the studio, and I didn't know where he called to Dude Station. It was no warning. He said, you know, I want you to come in and do this. We start next week. Fine. So I went and did it. So there was no dialogue up front. It was just got a phone call, and all of a sudden, there we were.
So as far as you knew, you might be going to do Young Americans Part 2.
Or I might not be going in the studio at all. I didn't know, because that's what he would do.
Yeah.
You know? So when he called me, I had no clue what he was going to do. There was no description of it. And what we did is, I don't think he knew. Matter of fact, I know he didn't know, because the only time that we recorded with him where we actually went into a rehearsal place for a few days. And he would just throw some ideas at us. We would throw ideas at him. And we were just jamming on these ideas for 3 or 4 days. And then we went in the studio.
So what was the dynamic in the band? So Carlos was still there. You were working alongside Carlos. How did that relationship work?
It worked great. It really did. I mean, because Carlos had that bedrock, clean, sort of funky James Brown-ish guitar rhythm style. And I was still in the rock and roll blues area. And it matched. It did really well. You know, when you listen to the record, a good way to listen to that is, I don't know, if you listen to the stereo and you go from left to right, the whole album, I'm on one side and Carlos is on the other side. So you can pan back and hear, I can't remember who's on which side, but you can hear the difference. And then when you put them together, if you listen to them separately, you wouldn't think they would work together. But when you put the full stereo in it, it works like a charm.
Yeah. It is a really nice meshing. I mean, I hear
it is.
On tracks like Golden Years, you know, there's quite a lot.
Absolutely. I'm doing a Memphis Cropper thing in that.
Right.
And then Carlos is doing that. That's more of James Brown rhythmy thing in that.
So initially you're just rehearsing, throwing around ideas, and he didn't really come with very much prepared then. That's interesting, because for such a substantial album, you'd think that he'd be coming in going, right, this is Station to Station, this is Word on a Wing, this is TVC 15. But
No. In fact, Station, the title track, is three bits put together.
Yeah.
Three separate parts that we were knocking around, and somehow he figured out how to make it work.
One of your great moments is this track, because you're all the way through, you know, that's you coming in at the beginning with holding that sustained note.
That's both me and David at the same time.
Oh, that's both of you at the same time. So yeah. He was playing guitar as well on the album.
That's the only thing I remember him doing, you know, because during the basic tracks, he didn't have a guitar on. He was just singing.
Do you remember when he played guitar, he would use?
On the beginning of that feedback thing, he was using one of my Stratocasters.
Right.
I'm pretty sure. It was one of mine, because he didn't bring one down.
There's a great quote I found here, which is him, Bowie, talking in 98. And he said, I can only think of one incident on Station. It's the only thing I can remember. And that was trying to get Slick. I remember working with her on the guitar sounds out in the studio itself and screaming the feedback sound that I wanted at him. And I really remember doing that. I also remember telling him to take a Chuck Berry riff and just play it all the way through the solo. Don't deviate. Just play that whole riff over and over and over again, even though the chords are changing underneath. Just keep it going. And he said, what, man? I said, it'll work. That's about all I can remember.
and that's accurate.
Yeah. So he was kind of,
I remember that.
He was kind of howling at you, going, this is how I want the feedback to sound. So I'm guessing that was Station to Station, because, you know, you come with that amazing sustained...
Right, and the funny thing about that is that I don't really count Young Americans as much, because that was very scripted, that record, but Station was really the first time that I worked with David on a record that was from the ground up.
Sure.
So knowing or thinking I knew how his brain worked, I would think that playing a Chuck Berry riff over David Bowie stuff would be like silly or not work or something. So when he told me that, obviously I was sure it's right up my alley. I can do that. And then as the solo went on, I came up with some other licks and stuff, which is one of the few solos that when I played live, when we did the shows, that was the only, I think it might be the only solo that I did live that I took note for note from the record, because nothing else would work.
You're talking about Station here.
Yes, the title track.
Yeah. So he's telling you to take a Chuck Berry riff, cycle through that, go through that, keep going. And then you kind of break out into this fantastic, euphoric, surging melody towards the end. Where did that come from?
That just popped out. That was not worked on. That just popped out.
That moment before the solo arrives, so you're doing your song and the solo's about, you know, you're a few bars away. You know, so what's going through your mind at that point?
I'm not thinking. No. It just whatever happens, you know. So on some of the solos with that approach, you'll hit on something right away. It might even be the whole thing.
Mm.
Or it might just be the direction you want to go in. But you got to let that happen.
Right.
And if for some reason that doesn't want to kick into gear, then you take a break and you just think it through. You know, but most of the solos are, at least the essence of the solo is on the fly.
Because it sounds like you're following the mood that's built up. I mean, it's three parts, like you just mentioned now. And it comes in from this very sinister, foreboding opening. Then it moves into Once There Were Mountains. And you know, it gradually gets higher and higher.
Yeah.
Did you record your solo? Do you remember? Did you do that in one pass?
On the station solo, yeah. I'm sure what we did was we did the Chuck Berry bit,
mm-hmm.
and then we probably stopped, and I probably punched in the other bit. I don't remember, but I'm guessing because I had to break away from the Chuck thing for the rest of it, and I don't remember how I did that. I mean, part of it would have been that as it progressed, I started feeling different, and whatever I felt is what popped out on the second half of the solo. But it wasn't in one, that one was definitely not in one go. I mean, you know, we did the Chuck Berry bit and then the other bit.
And do you remember the mood afterwards?
I don't remember. I don't remember. When you were in the studio like we used to do back then, I mean, we'd work ridiculous hours.
Mm.
You know, we'd be in there for like, sometimes we'd be in there for 15, 16, 20 hours. So you're brain dead in a way. Your functionality wasn't there anymore, but your creativity got better. So, you know, those things came out of sleep deprivation and cocaine or whatever. I don't know.
Well, he was being fueled by the same coke that Keith Richards was taking, which came from, what's it, Freddie
Same
Sessler.
Same guy.
Freddie Sessler, exactly.
It's amazing that the fucking coke dealer is as famous as the band 40 years down the line.
I only know that because I read Keith's book, and he goes into great detail about Freddie Sessler. Keith describes, you know, like Freddie would only get sealed Merc bottles. And we consequently, I didn't have to take that much. I just had to take a little bump just to get me up, and then that would keep me going. You know, it wasn't like, what does he call them? Mexican shoe scrapings. You know, he said there were no Mexican shoe scrapings. You know, I was just taking the best. And then I found out while researching you for this that David was also patronizing Freddie Sessler.
Yeah.
So he was getting fine quality stuff. This is why, like you're saying, these 40, and you were also indulging as well. And so, you know,
most
everyone was. So
we were over the top though. Yeah, we were over the top. There's no doubt about that. And you know, and during station recording, there were very rarely anybody but the band in that studio, other than the coke dealers were there more. I mean, there was nobody came in. I mean, there were occasionally somebody pop in, but.
We had the band, so this was Dennis Davis.
George Murray,
and yourself, and
Carlos.
And Carlos, that was it. So it was quite a tight-knit little unit, and obviously he would go on to work with those guys for years, so clearly he felt affinity with all of you. You mentioned earlier on this telepathy that you build up with a band. You know, like you say, you can just look at someone you're playing with, and they get where you're coming from, they get where you're going to go to. Did you feel that? Did you kind of click with all these guys quite early on in the sessions? Did you feel that connection?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you're talking about a period of time, too, where all of us, whether we were doing something with David or not, we were always out gigging all the time. So we were on our game, you know? It's like an athlete that just doesn't, you know, work out and then do the event. It would be like, some of these athletes, they're 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, and that's what we did. So, you know, we were in the headspace and the mode. So when you've got even guys that haven't worked together before, that even separately are out always performing and working, when you put them together in a room, that thing happens.
Because obviously you'd worked with Carlos, so you'd built up a relationship with Carlos.
Yeah, we knew what to do.
Yeah. You knew what to do. And I love this idea of the two of you coming from very different places, but just finding this connection, this way of playing off each other and with each other. But there's been a lot said over the years about the rhythm section, like the most amazing rhythm section ever.
Absolutely.
You know, and Dennis Davis, I mean, what a drummer. What an absolutely amazing drummer.
I know.
So for you, it must have been just like heaven to play with these
guys. It was great. I mean, it was just... You didn't think about what the other guys were doing because they were doing it and it just was right. You didn't think about it.
They just got you. They got you all the time.
We got each other and it just would fall right into place. You know, that was the magic of the whole situation. And you know, in all my years in doing this, it's a rare moment when you've got a band that clicks in like that.
It's everyone I've spoken to who's played with those guys says the same thing. I mean, they were just absolutely extraordinary.
Cold and
Golden Years is one of those songs that for many people is otherworldly. I read somewhere that, you know, he initially imagined it to be a kind of Elvis song.
I don't remember that part. I always felt it was a bit of Memphis Soul Stew.
Oh yeah.
With weird chord changes. It's got a Memphis funk to the track. You know, it does. But you know, the way David would structure the music would definitely be not the obvious. You know, because Golden Years, you know, could have been more obvious. You know, just because of the lick and stuff, it just flowed. But when he went into the changes in that, they were not obvious, which made that, maybe that's where that otherworldly thing comes from.
I think so. I think the changes are definitely unexpected. And you know what? He did this on, I remember watching Rick Wakeman playing Life on Mars, and he's demonstrating how weird this track is by the chord changes. So Wakeman obviously is a very accomplished pianist, and Bowie, you know, was a young kid at the time, well, a young performer at the time. And Rick Wakeman's saying, listen to this. Now, when I'm playing this, you expect it to go there. But no, Bowie goes there. And I think this is another case of that, right?
Yeah, and there's a good reason for that in the way I see it, is that David's never was a trained musician, you know?
Right.
And he had that music in his head. He was hearing this. Now, had he been trained, schooled, he might not have gone to those changes because they were definitely not the obvious place. If you took Songwriters 101, that stuff wouldn't be in there.
Right.
It wouldn't be there.
So he was doing it wrong, in a sense.
In a way, he was doing it wrong because he wasn't trained, but, you know, when you know too much, sometimes it inhibits your creativity to a point, you know?
Yeah.
Like you take Kurt Cobain. If you listen to Nevermind or the next album, I forgot the name of it, In Utero. The chord changes on that stuff at the time that came out were very odd, extraordinary. You know, and Kurt was the same thing. Not trained. He heard it in his head, so he played what he heard in his head.
I mean, you hear that on the intro to In Bloom, for example. You know, he does.
Yeah.
There are lots of very rapid, very choppy chord changes.
Yeah.
It's got that thing going on. I know.
Well, it's a funny thing about music is that, you know, what may seem wrong or out there, you hear it three or four times and it becomes normal. And just like now, we were talking about, I'm going to broach the subject a second. When we talk about the difference between the old rock bands and new rock bands and social media, if you look at what's happening in the world, and a lot of that crap started in this country, all of the toxic, you know, vitriol that's going on, had you acted like that pre-internet, you would have just been a lunatic that nobody would have listened to. But we've become desensitized to it. So anything that you keep repeating over and over again just becomes normal. So all that music that we did back then, the odd chord changes, lyrics that really didn't mean anything, that just sounded good, that people would read something into these lyrics, they just came out of nowhere, you know? And maybe when you first hear that stuff, it would sound extraordinarily weird, but after you played the record enough times, it becomes normal.
It becomes normal, exactly.
It becomes normal.
You touched just now on lyrics. When you heard the lyrics to any of these songs on the album, Golden Years, Station, did you... How much attention did you pay to the lyrics? Did you think about them, or was it just what David was doing and that was that?
It's what he was doing. I also knew as he was doing that those lyrics were going to change because I think originally on Station, when he sang the chorus, it was the final result, the European canon is here. It was originally the California canon is here. And I'm sure that exists somewhere on tape. But we were in California.
Right.
And he was just throwing stuff out there just to have something to sing while we were doing the track. You know, like the McCartney thing about him singing scrambled eggs for yesterday.
Well, I think that was something Bowie was quite well known for was, I can't remember if it's on Station, but certainly Man Who Sold the World, for example. He's literally out in the studio lobby scribbling down lyrics, coming in, doing it once. I think I did read that he did that for Golden Years, that he did it in one take or close enough to one take, you know, like he just put it down and got it out.
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, because when we were doing that record, lyrically, there were little phrases here and there, but by no means were they finished lyrics yet.
Yeah.
As opposed to Double Fantasy, that the lyrics were there. John came in with, he knew the lyrics top to bottom. He wrote those lyrics. But he also had 5 years off where he spent time doodling this stuff down.
Mm.
You know, Double Fantasy wasn't a last-minute idea. He'd been working on that for a while.
The ideas had been percolating in his mind for quite a while.
Yes, for quite a while.
I believe it was a kind of confidence issue with him. Like, he needed to get his confidence back and have the balls to go back in the studio and be like, okay, here, you know, here I am, and these are my songs.
You know, it that might sound odd to the public at large or the fans, you know, seeing the accomplishments and seeing the man, but all of us to a degree, like right now with the pandemic thing, I'm still feeling a little like my sea legs aren't quite there for live performances quite yet. You know, I'm doing them here and there, and once I do them, I'm fine. But when I'm thinking about doing them, it's a, you know, when you take a lot of time away from something, you get this false sense of insecurity. In between, when there's time off, you know, I'll pull up a video of some other guitar players, and I go, oh my God, man, you know. How am I going to go back to do this? You know, it was a pandemic thing for me.
They're sitting there in living rooms pulling videos of Slick going, oh, my God.
I know. We're all doing it. You know, it's, you know, the old riding a bike analogy is a good one because, you know, when I was a kid in Brooklyn, I rode my bike everywhere.
Mm.
I don't ride a bike anymore. But, you know, when I was during the pandemic, me and Glenn Matlock were taking bikes out just to get the hell out.
You were in London, weren't you?
Yeah. So it was the safest way to not get germs, I guess. That's what we thought.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got on the bike and I was no better or no worse than I was when I was 12 years old. I got on the bike and it rode itself. It's the same thing.
Just like
thing.
Riding a bike. You always Once get on that you, bike.
It's there. It's totally there. It never goes anywhere.
Golden Years. Golden Years was a track that, certainly for me, it's one of my all-time favourites, that track. I don't know what it is, and I've always, since I can remember, I've loved that guitar interplay, and I love now hearing how that's you and Carlos literally weaving into each other. There's the two things going on there all the way through, and it's just repetitive. And you know what? I hear a little bit of, he went to Europe next. He got really into these German groups that would just go on for ages and ages and ages doing very repetitive stuff, and I hear that at the outro of Golden Years. And you guys are just doing that lick over and over, and it's just perfect. Like I say, it's otherworldly, that track.
It is. It totally is. I mean, I didn't look at it at the time like that, but in hindsight, I do. I have a different ear for it now than I did back then.
What do you remember your ear for it back then?
It seemed normal. It seemed like this is what David does. We're doing a David record, and this is what it is. It didn't seem like it, you know. Because when that came out, a lot of the reviews were about the groundbreaking Station to Station. Yeah. And I thought, I don't remember breaking any ground. I was just playing my guitar.
I mean, obviously,
I see it now.
Yeah, but at the time, right, you didn't get
no,
that.
No, did way. Not register one bit back then, you know. Like it's said, you know, it comes back to the thing, too, is I was used to David doing changing horses midstream. And, you know, one day he dressed like this, one day he dressed like that, whatever. So it wasn't out of the ordinary for me at the time.
If we talk about you and David on a personal level, I mean, by now you were spending more time together. You said on the Diamond Dogs tour, you didn't really hang out together. By this point, obviously, both of you had pretty heavy habits. You were working 16, 20 hours on the Trotton Studio. How did you kind of bond as people? I know, how did you connect working together?
We didn't bond as people, really. We did in a very abstract way, because it was all based around connecting through the music.
Mm.
We didn't connect as people outside of that at all. It wasn't until 1983 when I came back in, when Stevie Ray Vaughan left the
Serious Moonlight
tour before it actually, you know, before it was even out of rehearsals, we connected as people really for the first time then, because, you know, we hadn't spoken since the around the release of Station. you know, there were business stuff that got in the way, and then we both kind of into this blah, blah, blah thing, and I left the band, and we kind of had to clear that up, you know, because I got called out of the blue to do that Serious Moonlight tour, because obviously David was in a bind, and I knew, you know, in hindsight, I realized Mick wouldn't have done it, you know. He didn't want anything to do with that at that point, and they called me to do it.
Was he under serious concern? But was he under consideration? Were they thinking about Mick?
I have no idea.
Right,
I never asked.
That would have been crazy, wouldn't it?
It would have been obvious as well. I mean, well, it was either one of us was obvious at that point, you know. But when they did call me to do it, I mean, I literally had 24 hours notice to fly over to Brussels to do the final rehearsals. And I do remember when I got there that I was a little nervous about not so much learning the material, because I've had stuff thrown at me. I could handle that, you know. But I thought, what's it going to be like David? Because we didn't leave on a good note.
Yeah.
So the first day I got there, he came and knocked on the door, and we went out to a cafe and we just, you know, threw it all on a table, and that was that. It was easy with him like that, because we both realized that in this business, when you're in a band, especially when you're under the microscope to the point that he was, and you're that successful, that it can cause animosities, it can cause all kinds of shit inside the family structure of the band. And, you know, knowing that, I just wanted to make sure that we got that straightened out, and so did he. And the good thing about him is we're both alike like this. Okay, that's what happened now. That was then. This is now. Fuck that. Let's move on. That was it. We had one conversation about it in 1983 and never had that conversation again.
Because you felt, didn't you, that it was the people around him.
Well, hell yeah. And that's what came out in our conversation.
Yeah, that neither of you, he didn't realize that. I mean, when you left, when you stopped working with him after Station, It was kind of getting messed. You were getting messed around by the people around David.
I can liken this, so it's very understandable. So Mom and Dad get divorced, and little Johnny is there, and Johnny goes over to visit Dad. Dad's saying this about Mom, and so he's getting two different stories, and that's basically what happened with us.
Yeah, yeah. But why?
Simple as that.
I mean, we'll get to that towards the end of the album, but I mean, it's amazing that you got back and you just had this ability to, like you say, the pair of you, okay, that was then, this is now, here we are, let's move forward.
Well, I always had regrets about leaving in the first place, and I think he did too, that I even left.
What do you remember about Word on a Wing? This very hymn-like number.
Okay, that's one song that what I remember about that, the chord changes on that song, not only were they odd, they had bits where, like, some bits would only happen for, like, two measures.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, having to digest that to... I was very concentrated on the guitars on that song. The overdubs were easy. Hmm. You know, once the melodies and stuff that I had to play came in, that was the easy part. But I do remember that out of all the songs on that record, funny enough, that was the hardest one to get in my head.
Really?
And it sounds more normal than Station by a long shot.
Well, exactly. That's what I would have thought. You would have said, yeah, that was easy. We just did that.
No. That was the hardest song on that record for me. I don't remember if it took that long. It was the rhythm part of it when we did the basic track that I was getting brain damage from. Once we did the track and the overdubs, that part was really easy. It just, because at that point, one thing about, what did David say to me one time? He said, I don't know what it is with you Italians. You can play these melodic things, but they still rock. Whatever that's supposed to mean, you know. But once we got the basic done, the rest of it was a piece of cake. Just for some reason, every once in a while, I'll hit a song that the chords just don't want to register.
Yeah. It's not a waltz. How do you describe it? I know what you mean now. It's like sounds very European almost. It's got like a Middle European sound to it.
I never thought of it. I mean, it does have a quirky feel to it, but I never really quantified what that is.
Yeah, I can't put my finger on it, but it's just now when you said that, I just thought, yeah, that's right. It doesn't, it's not, the bars aren't as long as you think they would be. You know, it's odd.
Yeah, there's odd spots in that. And the funny thing is that once we do these songs and they're finished, the listener is much more aware of the weirdness of it than we are, because we don't even discuss it when it's done. It just happens.
Yeah. I know I've asked you this before, but you wouldn't, after a session, hunker down with David, you wouldn't sit down and kind of review the work, or even the other members of the band, Carlos, the others, and kind of listen back and discuss what you've done, talk about it.
No.
No.
Nope.
You'd just be straight on, next thing.
That's it. Yeah, I mean, even up until the last record, when we did the next day, it was the same thing.
Me and Earl Slick taking it up to the end of side one of Station to Station, and the rest is on its way soon. If you like this episode, do let me know, or share it wherever you like. And until then, thank you for listening. A huge thank you to Slick, and bye from me for now.